more narrow the bandwidth you can set it for, and you could remove a significant portion of the background noise.
That's one of the reasons why it's more effective also, and people forget that. I think two or three, probably told you the story, a while back at a station on Easter Island, it was actually on one of the higher frequencies, it was almost completely covered by QRM, but I narrowed the filter on the flex radio to as narrow as it would go. I heard just fine and worked. Yeah, that worked.
Yeah, Flex being a software-defined radio, you can make real sharp filters without any ringing. The beauty of digital filtration.
Yeah, I don't play with it too much because I'm using a rental radio online, so I just kind of like very quickly narrowed it, worked the guy and got off. But, I didn't think of, you know, I that didn't even occur to me that when I use them, they have no ringing at the very narrow setting. I'm pretty sure you're right, but I hadn't thought about it. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's one of the big assets of software-defined radios. They use algorithm and digital filtration, and because they're not analog circuits, you can design them that where they just don't have a ring. So you can make them, it's not particularly the bandwidth that determines the ring, it's the cutoff, it's the slopes. And you can have a real sharp slope without ringing for digital filters.
Yeah, I would guess, I'm pretty sure on the Flex Radio you can really edit the filters to do very sharp slopes, or I think narrow skirts, or whatever, that I don't really play with all that, so I know I could. I know it's almost time for the space chat. I want to jump out here for a few minutes and try to get back in time for that. But Stone 3, good net tonight, B2BXO.
Thank you, Frank. I appreciate your participation as well. And 73, we'll talk to you down the line. Jim, I hope you're still around. I hope you haven't gone to sleep.
I'm here.
Okay, very good. What's your question or your comment for tonight?
So while we're on the esoteric, I'd like to continue something I started a week or two ago and ask some questions about 6 meters. Very intrigued. I'm thinking that in the early days of LimeWire, it must have been a bigger part of the what was going on. I recall being very young. I lived in Massapequa when I was very young, and I remember there was hams in the area with about 4.5-foot antennas on their cars, which leads me to believe they were working 6 meters. So I was wondering if anybody has any historical or current information on how was it, what was it like, was it useful, was it poor, most specifically in simplex operations. Any information would be useful. I'm going to try to set up in that mode, that band, I should say.
Okay, very good. If there's any LIMARC historians or just historians in general, I know just as anecdotal stuff that people used to have great fish stories for 6 meters during sunspot maximums. I haven't heard anyone with any kind of a great story this particular solar cycle, and I don't recall hearing any for the previous solar cycle when I first got my license. But if anyone out there has any information to offer Jim, a historical subject of 6 meters, what it once was, please hit that push to talk.
W2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
Well, I remember.
remember 6 meters. It's sporadic E, right, Roy?
It doesn't have to be sporadic E. It works. It used to work fine for just the height of the sunspot cycle.
Well, I don't remember that, but I do remember working 6 meters AM, especially during the summer, where you had this sporadic E skip, and it was very, very exciting. I mean, during the, you know, the rest of the year, it was just like 2 meters AM. But during the summer, you'd have these openings, like from Virginia to California and whatever, very few and far between. But I remember as a kid, every night, tuning around 6 meters for an opening. Other than that, I didn't really find any difference between 6 meters and 2 meters, other than for about 4 to 5 houses from mine, I messed up everybody's TV signal. And neighbors, when they found out that it was me, would call my parents to tell them that I was screwing around with their TV reception. And it was quite scary for me, because my parents were really pissed off that I was doing this, that I was capable of it, especially my next door neighbors. I just totally wiped out every channel from channel 2 to 13 of their TV enjoyment. So that's what I remember about six meters. Go ahead.
Okay, that's interesting. I was talking just this morning on 10 meters about the bad old days where there was a lot of broadcast radio and TV, and you inevitably interrupted someone's listening pleasure and had to listen to their opinion of you. Nowadays, everything's streamed, everything's satellited. You know, you don't have to worry too much about that. But those are good. So apparently you don't recall having much experience with 6 meters during sunspot peaks?
No, in fact, I don't even remember sunspot peaks in general, because I was only a novice and then a technician, so I was not able to get on the low bands except CW. And when I was young, CW was out of the question. To get the extra class license, I had to be able to copy at 20 words a minute. And I really pounded away for a year. I wish they still had, you know, a requirement that you learn CW. Because as great as it's getting now, basically because of POTA, it would even be better than that now. But no, I wasn't concerned with the sunspot cycle, because all I could talk on was 2 and 6 meters. So I didn't live and die by the sunspot cycle, Roy. Go ahead.
Yes, Frank?
KD2FIU.
Okay, first Frank, then George.
Okay, 2 or 3 years ago, before the actual peak, there were some really good 6 meter openings to Europe and Africa. So I worked them from remotes in Connecticut, 100 watt dipole remotes in Connecticut and Maine on the coast. Worked a couple of Europeans on CW, I think Sierra 50A, I think it was. I think that's Slovenia on CW. And were Madeira Island on FT8 and a couple of other European and Caribbean stations on FT8, 10 countries all told. But interestingly, the last year or so, supposedly in the sunspot peak, I've seen a great deal in the way of European and Asian DX spots, but at least in the station I have access to, I have not been decoding them on FT8 for the most part. And most of the Sirius DX operation now on 6 meters, it appears to be FT8, the WB2BX, so.
Oh, okay. I never tried FT8 on 6 meters. I think I tried it on 10 and of course below, but I've never tried it on 6. Something I have to, do. Probably I'm going to wait until 10 meters wakes up, because I assume what's screwing up 10 meters is also to a degree screwing up 6 meters. But very good there, George. You wanted to say something?
KD2FIU. Yeah, Roy, my question for Jim is, what mode do you want to work? And do you want to work from your base or your mobile? Do you want to work SSB? Do you want to work, excuse me, FM from your mobile? Jim, over to you.
Very deductive. That's just what I was thinking. I was thinking into voice modes, FM and SSB, primarily mobile, some base, and I'm not really aiming at DX as much as a county-wide or county or three. Something akin to what we're doing on the repeater is what I'm wondering if that was then is and could be a useful function.
I think I got your answer was FM on the mobile. Is that correct?
FM or SSB, mobile primarily.
Okay, thank you. So this is a very wide band. So you're not going to be able to cross SSB into FM with a single antenna. SSB is going to be primarily horizontal, and of course it's going to have multi-elements involved with giving you some gain. FM from the mobile, I have worked. And I'll give you an idea where the frequencies are. And it does work, by the way. There is a simplex portion on FM, and there is a repeater portion on FM. So if you were to tune your mobile antenna for FM, where did I do it? I got to think of probably between around 51.5 to 51.2. That's going to give you FM, and most important, it's going to be the repeater inputs, because you're transmitting. The repeater outputs are going to just come into you. You don't need to really tune antenna for that. So the repeater inputs are going to be between maybe 51.1 to 51.5. Then you're in the simplex mode. In the middle there is another kilohertz. Now, coming out, FM, repeater out, is going to be 51 to 52. But I'm giving it to you in plus or minus a few hundred KC or in there. So that doesn't matter. So you're looking at 51 to 52 is where you want to build your FM mobile antenna. That's your output SWR resonance. That's going to give you FM repeaters because of the output, the input frequency of your repeater, and the output of the simplex frequencies that you want to work. Jim, any portion of that, I'll repeat. KD2FIU.
So I wrote it down. It's interesting. And what kind of range would you expect mobile to mobile in those that frequency range? With, let's say, 4.5 foot width.
But you're going to have a resonant antenna. And sometimes you can bring, there are certain antennas that are 51 to 55 inches that have a loading coil that'll give you quarter wave. 55 to 51 inch whip with quarter wave center mount on the roof of the vehicle, and they're very effective. The range depends upon the conditions. You know, there are some repeaters in this area. There are other repeaters outside of this area, but it's a nice feature to have. I have this feature myself. 6 meter FM and simplex from the mobile. I like it.
Thank you for the feedback. Back to Roy.
Okay, very good. If anyone else has any historical information about 6 meters, please hit that push to talk. Okay, Jim, I think that's it for tonight. Anything else?
No, thank you for that. You can go on. KD2BHD.
Okay, very good. Thank you for participating, Jim. Thank everyone for participating tonight. I hope you had some fun. I enjoyed it. I learned a few things, and that's always a good thing. So thanks to everyone. And now it's a perfectly good time for Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report.
Okay, thanks, Roy. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, yeah, a couple of things. Oh, by the way, I don't know if Rich is still listening, but something called Morse Mania. It's an app. And if you have, like, a tablet, it's a little too small for a cell phone would be too small, but a tablet would be good. And the first part of it is free, you know, like a lot of apps, and then eventually you would be charged if you get more advanced. But you know, they do the whole alphabet, and as you're hearing the letters, you're touching the keyboard, you know. So it's good if you want to learn typing too, I guess. But it's pretty interesting. I just did that a couple of days ago, just for fun. But then I realized it's you know, you have to pay, and I'm not going to get involved with that. But it's like a game, you know, to see if you copy the letters and touch the keyboard, the proper letters at the same time. Very interesting. Anyway, yeah, let me go on with the SpaceNet report. Talking about paywalls for money, the website I've been going to for years, one of the ones I got great information from was Space News. Well, Space News Now, you know, you can go on it, but you know, you read the first paragraph or so, and that's, now they wanted to, they want you to pay money for that. So that, I crossed that off the list, but they all tend to be going that way, little by little. You know, it's the first one that I see in the space world that has joined that group. But anyway, it'd just be a terrific site. Probably, I guess, over 20 years. I just deleted that. So anyway, there's a flight that's going to be leaving the International Space Station called Axiom 4. They've been attached to the space station for a couple of weeks. And it was a crew of four sent up by Falcon 9 by a private company called Axiom 4. You know, the name of the company is Axiom, but it's the fourth mission. They've done this three previous times where they launch, they dock with the space station, they stay for a couple of weeks, and then they leave, and they have an agreement with NASA to And the only rules for the private company is whoever flies the spacecraft, the commander, has to be either a present or an ex-NASA astronaut. So in this case, it's Peggy Whitson. She's been up, oh, I guess three or four times for NASA, but she's retired, and she now flies for Axiom. And they don't have their own rocket. They use the Falcon 9 to do it. The goal of Axiom is to put modules up attached to the space station, a series of modules where you could live in. They expect maybe to be able to eventually handle four people in their modules. And sooner or later, the ISS will deorbit. When that happens, these four modules that ACT will have attached over the years, next who knows how many years, probably until maybe 2031, will separate ISS, and it will be a standalone space station with docking ports and everything, their own solar panels. That's their goal. But for now, they send up crews. And they had three people that were with Peggy Whitson. They were from different countries. One was from Poland, one was from Hungary, and again, they do this on a regular basis now. There'll be eventually an Axiom 5, probably within maybe by the end of the year or by early next year. Now, there's another flight that's going to be going up. That group is coming down, but another group is going up, a regular NASA crew. When NASA sends them up, they don't stay for 2 weeks. They stay for, 5 to 6 months. So that crew is, they call it Crew 11. Again, they're going up on a Falcon 9 rocket. And it looks like they'll be going up at the end of the month. The crew that I just talked about, they'll be deorbiting maybe tomorrow. And this one goes up July. The end of the month is the planned flight for this group. And Zena Codman, another woman, she's going to be the commander of this flight. Mike Finch, he's been up before. He's going up as well. And then two others, one from Japan and another one from Russia. So you're going to have three astronauts and one cosmonaut going to the International Space Station at the end of the month for a 6 month stay. So looking forward to for the crew coming back and this crew going up. And you have seven people on the International Space Station. And with the four that you have up there now, you have 11. But that four will come back. You'll have seven, and they like to keep it around seven people living on the space station. Any comments? Okay. I don't know if anybody read the science news. This comet that was discovered, and it comes from another solar system, not from our own. And I think the closest approach is coming up very shortly. It won't come to Earth. It will be the closest it will come. It's near the orbit of Mars, but it's the third time that scientists have discovered a visitor from, from outside of our solar system. They had one in 2019. Then they had the first one. There was a lot of news about that. That was Oumuamua, the very long looking comet, very strange. They thought it had its own propulsion and all, but anyway, that thing came flying through the solar system and left. And they know these things, these items, are from another solar system because of the speed. This one, by the way, the name of it is 31 Atlas. It's flying through at 158,000 miles per hour. Anything going that fast, they know, could not have originated within our solar system. And it's not part of an orbit of the sun. So it's just going to pass Mars, just going to keep on going, and then leave and never come back. So with better instruments, telescopes that we have nowadays, I think these things are going to be more common in the future. Especially now we have the Vera Rubin telescope that just came online that I've been talking about for a couple of weeks now. With that thing stares at the sky, and every 10 days it'll scan the entire southern hemisphere. And eventually, when they get all the data together, it becomes a movie. It's like staring at the stars, and if you see little things moving in the background, the questions come up, and you find out what it is. And in this particular telescope, they found out that there was at least 2,000 asteroids moving in the scene when they first did this. And the thing's only been open for a couple of weeks. So you can imagine what's going to happen, a couple of months or years from now with the Vera Rubin telescope. So if something is passing through at, say, 150,000 miles per hour or more, they're gonna know it's very similar to 31/Atlas, as an interloper from another solar system. Any comments? Okay, I think it was last week or a week before, I was talking about different spacecraft that discovered new worlds on different planets, different solar systems. And one of the ones I mentioned was Gaia. And Gaia was put up by the European Space Agency back in 2013. And it lasted over years. Eventually, it ran low on fuel and had a couple of other technical problems. They only thought it was going to last originally for 3 to 5 years or so, and it lasted over 10 years. So the European Space Agency got their money's worth. But the Gaia did discover quite a few planets that it looked at. I mean, the main goal of Gaia was to really map the universe and try to get a 3D version of what the universe looks like. When you look at the sky, everything looks, 2D. This thing had the capability of converting those stars into a 3D pattern. And eventually with a computer, you could actually, fly through the different parts of the universe. The thing is taking pictures of. And they have enough data, even so the mission ended early this year, back in March. They have enough data to probably keep them busy, from what I read, for the next 10 to 15 years. So, it takes a long time to process all that information. Okay, let the CW go by. anyway, the spacecraft was launched, like I said, by back in 2013 by Ariane Space. And back then we didn't have a big problem with Russia. So Ariane Space used to buy Soyuz rockets from Russia, and they set up a launch complex in Kourou, French Guiana. And down in Guyana, in South America. So Kourou was the launch complex. And they have this beautiful launch facility to launch Soyuz rockets. You know, Soyuz was always rocket launched from the lands in Russia, a couple of different complexes in Russia. But they also set this thing up in Guyana. And that back then in 2013, it was okay to, you know, for the European Space Agency to deal with Russia. And they used to have their technicians, you know, people come over, set everything up. So ESA paid for it, Russia delivered it, and it was launched from their complex. They did quite a few launches from there. And one of the spacecraft they put up was Gaia. It was maybe about 18 feet long, 15 feet wide. It had a 2,000-watt capability out of its location, operated out in the L2 location beyond the moon. And they operated S-band. They'd receive on S-band, and then Gaia would transmit on X-band back to Earth. But it stayed there all those years, and now they pushed it out of its orbit, like got a halo orbit with that moon. And it's like a million miles away from Earth. The moon is roughly a quarter of a million miles, so it's like four times the distance. And that's where Gaia was. Same location where now James Webb Space Telescope is also located, out in that area. So, you can say goodbye to Gaia, but the scientists will be pouring through the information for probably decades to come. Any comments? WS2S. Okay, nothing heard. ULA is getting ready for another launch of Vulcan rocket. Vulcan is the new rocket that's replacing the Atlas V rocket. Atlas V's got maybe about a half a dozen more flights left in it. And Vulcan is bigger. It can carry more payload to orbit. And they've launched two times successfully so far. They use engines that are built by Jeff Bezos' company, Blue Origin, called BE-4 engines. The BE-4 engines are liquid methane, liquid oxygen. So they've flown successfully twice. Each one has two engines, so that's four engines there, 100%. And then Blue Origin launched their own rocket, the New Glenn, earlier this year. And that was seven engines in one shot on their first stage. And that rocket got to orbit. But the B-4 engines are very successful. And ULA is actually buying them for their Vulcan rocket. So that, now they're setting up a new rocket to be launched. And looks like that will probably be going up a couple of months. It's going to be a launch for the government, national defense. Any government launches to be certified, they need to have a brand new rocket, in this case Vulcan, to have two successful flights. It's already done that, and that's how they get certified. So the designation for this rocket is called the BC-4S. So the B, of course, stands for Vulcan, and then C-SEN stands for Centaur. The upper stage, you know, is a proven stage that's been around for decades, and that's liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. So like I said, the first stage is liquid methane, liquid oxygen. Second stage, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. It has two Centaur, it's got two rockets made by Rocketdyne for the second stage. So that's what the C stands for, BC-4S. Now the 4, that stands for the boosters that are attached to the Vulcan rocket. Vulcan could fly by itself without any boosters. But let's say you need $500,000 of thrust, you put one booster on. You want 2 million pounds of thrust, you put two boosters on. They've already flown the two booster configuration. They've got that under their belt, although they did have a problem with one of the nozzles, but they got through that. So ULA is going to be launching the four solid booster segments, and they're made by Northrop Grumman. So they're called GEM-63XL. So graphite type of rocket. 63 inches long, 63 inches in diameter, and XL is the long version of, you know, of the solid booster rocket. So each one will have around 500,000 pounds of thrust. Put four of them on, you're going to get 2 million there, and another million with the BE-4 liquid methane, liquid oxygen engines. So it's a much more capable rocket than the Atlas V. It has the capability of putting six of these boosters on if needed. Atlas V has the capability of, you know, running with no boosters, or one all the way up to five, but this one could do six, and that's what eventually they'll be doing. They'll be doing that with the Kuiper flights. I've talked about them before. They're going to put thousands of those satellites into orbit. They're broadband communication satellites competing directly with SpaceX. They only need 3,200 to be fully operable. But it goes on for the next couple of months. There's going to be quite a few flights. They already have around 50 or so, almost, was it 27? I think it was 27 on the first flight, 27 on the second flight for the Atlas V. So they already got a bunch up there. All of them are 100% successful. Now when SpaceX goes, they send up these things, and some of them don't work. They have to deorbit them. Not the problem. So far, it's 100%. We'll see how it goes as time goes on. They have many contracts already signed with Vulcan to keep sending these things up, month after month, year after year for a while. And when they send them up, they're sending up five at a time because they could lift, you know, heavier lift than the Atlas V. Atlas V could do 27. This one, Vulcan could do 45 at a time. But Amazon needs more than, you know, a lot more flights than what Vulcan could do. So they've actually contracted out with Ariane 6 launch vehicle. That's European Space Agency heavy launch vehicle. And they're also going to use the New Glenn rocket. That's the one being built by Blue Origin to launch large amounts of satellites. And they even have a contract with SpaceX, their competitor, to put some Kuiper satellites in orbit as well. Any comments? Okay, nothing heard. Talking about the ESA, European Space Agency, they had a couple of days ago, I think it was the 7th, they ran a test. They are really into laser communication, similar to what NASA did. NASA, a year ago, had a successful communications with their spacecraft that's going to Psyche. It's called the Psyche spacecraft, and it's going to an ion asteroid called Psyche in the asteroid belt. So it's on the way there, you know, as we speak. But one of the gadgets that they to Psyche was a receiver and transmitter of optical capability using lasers. So yeah, they have RF, of course, that's their main transmitting capability. But as a test, they hooked up optical laser, and it was successful. NASA did it a couple of times, like 10 million miles out, and then they did 20 miles out. Now the spacecraft is out in the 30 or 40 million mile location away from us. European Space Agency wants to get involved with this too. So that's what they did. They had two units, ground units, one as a transmitter and one as an optical receiver set up. And what they did is they transmitted to, I wrote down the mileage. It was 260 million kilometers. That gives you an idea. 1.8 AU astronomical units from Earth, and they did it as well, similar to what NASA did, transmit signal, and then sure enough, another signal came back, and it worked out okay. This is important because eventually when astronauts go to distant places like Mars, they want to communicate with Earth, not just with RF. It's a capability because, you know, you're going to want to be sending a tremendous amount of data back and forth, including, maybe high-definition video. But to do that, you know, you really need a tremendous amount of throughput. The amount that you get with laser communication in the optical range is, they estimate, minimum 10 times more than RF, but they're guessing up to about 100 times the capability of RF. So it's good that they now have that capability. It will free up the Deep Space Network, which is a group of antennas on the Earth, three main areas. One in California, Goldstone, California. another one in Madrid, Spain, and another one in Canberra down in Australia. So, you know, they're set at 120 degrees apart from one another around the Earth. This way, the space network is always looking, you know, at some point of the sky where you communicate. Right now, I think they're doing over 40 different spacecraft that need to communicate with these deep space networks. So you know, you could envision an optical setup in the future where they're sending tremendous amounts of data in the future, and that will free up deep space network time. You know, and each area, you know, Gulfstone, Madrid, Canberra, you know, it's not like they have one antenna there. Big dish antennas. They have a series of antennas. So, you know, you might have four or five antennas at each location right now and doing the work. So, any comments? This is WS2N.
B2BS, though.
Hi, Frank. How you doing? WV2BXO, WS2N.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier, but I was doing something else for the moment about the space news services being behind paywall. Have you looked at Universe Today? I usually listen to their podcasts, but I believe they also have a website and a Patreon. And they do have Fraser Cain in his promotions says that there is at a free level of Patreon. If you want something that's not behind a paywall, you may try either his podcast or YouTube or Patreon video. So go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Verse 6. They're very good. Yeah, of course, you know, you start with NASA, and then I work my way down. But it's a shame to see space news go away. You know, I go to NASA, and then I see space news, and I used to go to spaceflightnow.com, very good, spaceflightnow.com. And then, Daily was okay. I go there. University Today, I have them on my list. I go there. You're right, Frank. They're very good. And then NASASpaceflight.com is a terrific website. And it's really the same group, but they have a launch schedule as well. That's SpaceflightNow.com. I go to launch their schedule. And you get the up and coming launches. They used to have a lot more. I mean, they cover like 6 months at a time. And now they, for some reason, maybe because everything's haywire lately in the government, they don't as many launches like they used to. But that's good. And of course, SpaceX.com is, you know, for their launches. Good. Another one I like is the Deep Space Network. I mentioned that before, all the different antennas. If you go to, they call it eyes.gov/DSN, that stands for Deep Space Network, and then again, and then DSN, .html. It's just a website that comes up showing the Deep Space Network antennas. And they'll show those three locations, Goldstone and Madrid, you know, Australia. And when you look at that website, you know, some of the antennas look like they have, like, radio waves coming off of them. And then there's little designation, you know, MRS or something that would stand for, you know, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. I mean, MRO, different names, different initials. You click on that, and it'll tell you which space they're looking at. They might be Voyager 1 or Voyager 2 or New Horizons, you know. I spent a lot of time on Deep Space Network website. Anyway, yeah, thanks for that, Frank. Yeah, Space News is, well, it's not gone, but, you know, they want money. Back to you.
Yeah, very good. I guess that's pretty common now, but as you said, there are some alternatives. Anyway, all right, I know we're almost to the witching hour, so let's go ahead and finish up. WB2BXO.
Okay, Frank. One of the looked at recently was, you know, you look at that website, the Deep Space Network, and the Biocentennial spacecraft came up. I had forgotten which one this was, but as I was reading it, I rang a bell. This thing went up on the first SLS mission, the one that sent the human spacecraft around the moon and back, which was, you know, a couple of years ago already, I guess. That went up in November of 22. And, you know, the goal was to see if a human spacecraft, you know, was going to hold together and everything, and then the whole launch complex itself, and the vehicle itself, the space launch system, how it was all going to go with the solid boosters and all. And, you know, well, but inside of, you know, when they separated the stages, they had, there were 10 different satellites that they planned on launching. They were going to do different things. One was going to orbit the moon, one was going to do this, one was going to do that. And one of them that they had was called the Biocentennial. And it pushed that out. It's heading for, I believe it's going to be heliocentric. It's probably going to be going around the sun eventually. But this thing launched into space on Artemis 1. It's still functioning. What they're doing, it's a small, you know, it's maybe a 6-cube type of spacecraft. Not full, but inside it's got some kind of yeast that could grow, different types of yeast, something to do with the DNA. I don't know. I started reading it, but you know, if they can get information out of it when it's in this area that's really not protected by any radiation whatsoever. They want to see if this yeast, what happens to it. And from the answers that they get from what they're looking at, they'll be able to determine, you know, some safety risk that will be for the different astronauts, you know, when you go into not only space, but, you know, deep space. So, sure enough, look at the Deep Space Network. I see this, the graphics of signal going off one of the antennas, going off of Madrid at the time, and look at this. I completely forgot about that. All these years later, still working. Anyway, hope Artemis 2 goes with a real crew. We'll have to wait for that. But that should be going up. You know, maybe in the springtime of next year, and that's the year, the time, maybe April or May. So we'll see. I don't know what's going on with the government. It's in bad shape. But it looks like NASA's still funding the manned space programs. They want you want to cut a lot of science programs, which is just terrible. But we'll see. Maybe we can get that reversed eventually. Any comments? Okay. Just one more quick announcement. There's an astronaut. She's been flying for many, many years. Astronaut for like 30 years. Involved with the space programs, you know, for 38 years. But Shannon Walker, she's retiring. And many flights. She flew up on a Soyuz rocket one time. She flew up on a space station, on a shuttle, flew to the space station. She was the first woman to actually fly on a Falcon 9 rocket, you know, when they first started flying back in 2020, that time frame. But Shannon Walker retired, and she's a ham, KD5DXB. So, wish her luck, and very good. Hope she uses the call letters. If you look her up, there's like 3,500 people now that have contacted Shannon, or look her up anyway. Look her up in the, QRZ. Any comments before we close? This is WS2N for the Space Network Report. Okay, nothing else, nothing heard. Don't have anything else. We'll be back next week, hopefully. Now we'll try to get on tomorrow night on the Club InfoNet on these frequencies. That's always good. That starts at 8:30, not 8 o'clock like this net. And that's always
net
followed
time
by
complete.
Swap and shop, and that's by George. Does a great job on that. And then that's always followed by Radio Newsline. And for now, we're going to turn this back over to Roy, AC2GS, WS2N. Thanks for letting us do this part of the net. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you for doing it, Paul. Thank you for all that you do for the SpaceNet Report, all that you do for the Technical Net, and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And thanks and appreciations to everyone who participated tonight. Hope you had some fun. Hope you learned some things. I hope you'll join me next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. As is my usual practice, I just want to remind you of two great quotes from two great men. Our own Dick, K2RAW, always ended his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other, and that's always good advice. And then there's good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open, but not so open that your brain falls out. Everyone, have a great week. Stay safe, be well, stay cool, stay dry, and we'll talk to you down the line, hopefully next Sunday night. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear after I say, Slava Ukraini.